Welcome to The Gaggle, an AZ Central podcast where we chat with reporters, experts, and special guests to keep you fully informed on the state's political news. I'm your host, Yvonne Winget Sanchez. I cover national politics for the Arizona Republic.
And I'm Ron Hansen, also a national reporter for the Republic.
We're coming to you on the night of the election, November 3rd. We're looking at what we know and what we don't know about the election results. And we'll give you a sense of what comes next.
We'll be recording different segments at various points throughout the night.
It's 1:20 a.m. on Wednesday, the day after the election, and we do not know who will be the president of the United States for the next 4 years. But we do know that Arizona has voted for former Vice President Joe Biden and Democrat Mark Kelly for the U.S. Senate. Kelly's win gives Arizona a pair of Democratic senators, and this hasn't happened since 1953. Let's go ahead and break down the races. Before we dive into the presidential and Senate races, let's take a look at how Arizonans actually voted. Joining us to do that is the Republic senior data reporter, Rob O'Dell. Rob, thanks so much for hopping on with us so late. How are you holding up?
I'm all right.
Are you really, though?
Every 4 years we do this, or every 2 years, so we're all good.
Okay, Rob. So we are recording this segment at about 11:35 p.m. on Tuesday. Rob, let's talk about what voter turnout looks like at this point, and let's go first to early voter turnout. How did that look compared to previous election years?
Well, I mean, it was huge, really. 2.6 million people, at least, turned out their ballots before Election Day. And that's more people than voted in the entire election in 2016, the entire presidential election. And then we still have early votes that were sent in the mail and weren't counted, and ones that were dropped off at the polls. And then it seems like we had like a decent but not huge turnout on Election Day. So the amount of people who voted in Arizona is certainly going to be a record. It's just a matter of, or it's certainly going to be a record for the number of people who have voted. We're going to clear 3 million for the first time ever. We may approach the all-time record for turnout, which is 80%, or we may get close with 77 or 78. But either way, you know, a record number of people have participated in this election.
Can you talk a little bit about what we saw in terms of in-person voting on Election Day? What did that look like in terms of turnout?
So in-person was not particularly huge in Maricopa. More Republicans turned out than Democrats. It was about 30,000 from the last voters from the last thing that I saw earlier today. But there were a ton of independents, too. So, you know, people like to look at the Republican-Democratic split. But one, you don't know how Democrats and Republicans voted themselves. But the independents are this other huge block, and we don't know how they went.
So all really interesting. Can you just kind of give us a glossary of what you mean by late earlies, day ofs, et cetera? I mean, and in what order are those ballots counted?
So anything that comes in and is able to be counted before Election Day is what people generally call early earlies, which is, you know, anything that in Maricopa they came through, they counted through Sunday. Pima County and some other counties counted through this morning. And so whatever they have left over and whatever was dropped off at the polls. So whatever didn't come, whatever came in the mail after they stopped counting, and whatever early ballots were dropped off at the polls are often called late earlies. So those aren't count. Those need to be signature verified, and they aren't counted until after Election Day. And then you get the votes at the polls, and those are counted later on Election Day. And then so it leaves votes after Election Day to be counted, those late earlies and then provisional votes where people had issues with their ID. And that's sort of what drives this, you know, count that takes several days. Like, well, we don't have a winner in these close races. It's because we still have 500,000 votes still to count. And in some of these races, if there are 1,000 votes, I mean, that could easily swing the margin.
Okay, so speaking of counts, how did this election administration go as far as we can tell at this point? Were there widespread glitches? Are there massive problems? Was it pretty smooth sailing?
As far as I can tell, it was pretty smooth sailing. I mean, we had, you know, reports of voter intimidation, but that was not like at very many places, and that was not people honking horns and holding signs. That to me, like, if you would have told me before today that's what we were going to be, I think everyone would have signed up for that. You know, we were worried about having militias at the polls and stuff. And then the counting, I think, has gone generally pretty well. I mean, just look at the map, you know, look at Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin and say that we didn't do well counting early votes. I think we did pretty well. We're sort of waiting on some of the day of votes. You know, they haven't come in real fast tonight, but sometimes they don't come in fast. I mean, we've waited longer than this. So I think it's pretty much gone on without a hitch.
So again, we're recording this shortly before midnight on election night. Do you have a sense of how many votes remain to be counted as of now?
See, this is sort of the difficulty that we run into, and this is why we try to track these from every county recorder, because we don't know right now how many ballots were dropped off at the polls. So based on some work I did with some pollsters, there's likely between 500,000 and 800,000 votes out. If there's 800,000 votes still left to count, then we would hit, you know, we would break the all-time turnout record. So, I mean, I think that's a good number to think of. And it just depends where they are. I mean, much of them are going to come from Maricopa County because that's the largest place in the state, right? And then we're going to have some from Pima and smaller amounts from the other counties. And it just sort of depends how they break up to whether they can flip races. You know, like 10,000 votes in Yavapai can flip a CD race or a congressional district race or a legislative race. But it's not going to flip the state margins. Whereas, you know, 250,000 ballots from Maricopa, which we know that. We know Maricopa is sitting right now on 250,000 ballots that they haven't counted that came in before Election Day. We don't yet know what they had, what was dropped off at the polls. So in previous years, we've had at least 600,000 votes statewide still to count after Election Day. We may not have that many, but I expect it to be in that neighborhood, 400,000, 500,000.
Okay, so the magic question with all of that then is, how long do we expect the counting to go on? Is this going to be done Wednesday? Will it take longer than that?
Well, the counting is not going to be finished for at least a week, because people who cast provisional votes have 5 business days to bring in their ID. So we're not going to have like final numbers for a week. So we'll be counting for an entire week, but we may know winners in certain races.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Rob, for joining us and being a Sherpa on election night as we wade through all of this data and all of these late, early election day terms. Where can listeners find you if they want to follow you on Twitter?
They can find me on Twitter at Rob Odell AZ.
All right, on to the biggest race of the night. Of course, that is the presidential race. Ron, it's actually technically Wednesday morning. We're recording this segment at 1:20 a.m. Give us a sense of what the results look like.
Yeah, so the AP just called the state of Arizona for Joe Biden. That is the first state that the Democrat has flipped from Donald Trump and his 2016 performance. It also keeps alive his hopes to try and win this presidential race. So a very big result. We also see that Governor Doug Ducey continues to ask for patience in counting all the ballots before anybody declares victory here. But At the moment, the Associated Press has called this state for Joe Biden. Yvonne, both campaigns took really different approaches to trying to win this state. Democrats stayed out of the field most of the year. They put a lot of energy into flipping John McCain supporters. The Trump team really got out, knocked on doors, and relied a lot on Donald Trump's personal appeal, especially in those airport hangar rallies to offset their lagging finances. How do those strategies look in hindsight at this point?
Well, in hindsight, it looks as though the strategy did not work for President Trump, and it did work for Joe Biden. In the final days of the campaign, Trump really sought to shore up conservative base voters. These are people who are very enthused about his presidency, are, you know, almost completely on board with his Make America Great Again agenda, are fairly unbothered by some of his more maybe outrageous, as some would say, rhetoric. And, you know, earlier in the cycle, it seemed as though he was really trying to shore up support in the suburbs, some of these maybe independent voters, some of these suburban women who have drifted away from the Republican Party in the era of Trump. But really, in the final stretch, it does seem as though it was a base strategy. And it clearly worked in rural Arizona, where he drew a lot of support as expected. But Biden dominated, according to early results, in the more populous areas of the state, in Maricopa County and in Pima County. These are two counties that the Biden campaign tried very hard to, you know, reach voters virtually with small gatherings, by contactless voter literature, door knocking efforts. And, you know, he really went with one message, and that was, you know, President Donald Trump has been wholly inadequate in his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. And it appears as though enough voters in Arizona agreed with him. Ron, why do you think Arizona voters ultimately went for Biden? And what might this say about our state?
Yeah. So, you know, I guess I start with 2016. Donald Trump, when he won this state, he only got 48% of the vote. And we had sort of abnormally high third party votes, maybe triple the usual rate on that. You know, you start with that 48%, and you look at how he antagonized those who still believe and think well of John McCain. He also, you know, sort of made sport of lambasting Senator Mitt Romney. That is something that didn't sit well with a lot of folks in the Mormon community. He also had the reported comments that he disputes, but the comments insulting military personnel. I think at the end of the day, the president didn't do enough to expand his base in a state where he already started in a minority position. And that kind of situation, especially during a pandemic, just really left him on the outside looking in, hoping against reality, as it turns out at this point, that he could somehow eke out a victory in a place that it was pretty clear he already had problems in. So given all of that, it shouldn't be that much of a shocker that this state is one of the few bright spots at the moment in terms of transforming the presidential map for Democrats. Yvonne, Arizona got a lot of unprecedented attention from Republicans and spending from Democrats that was off the charts. Did we deserve that kind of swing state treatment at the end of the day?
Of course, we always deserve to be courted. Yeah, I mean, the swing state treatment was always inevitable with a state like Arizona, just given the demographic changes that we have long talked about here in the Gaggle and in the pages of the Arizona Republic. We're a fast-growing county. We are a rapidly changing ethnic community with just the sheer growth of Latino voters who tend to swing Democratic. And Trump's presidency simply seemed to accelerate that. This is something that we have been reporting on over the last several years. It has come to fruition. I would expect some sort of reset in the coming years. I don't think that, you know, Arizona is blue forever. Clearly, things will start to swing in the other direction. But, you know, I think we're going to be a swing state for a lot of years to come.
Let's turn to the Senate race now. This race saw Democrat Mark Kelly defeat Republican Senator Martha McSally. The Associated Press called that race at about 1 a.m. on Wednesday, and that brought to an end this state's epic race that had been going on since a year ago. Yvonne, let's talk about how this race unfolded and what it means for the state politically into the near-term future.
Well, just to start, Martha McSally, who was appointed to the seat in 2018 after losing her race for the Senate that year to Kyrsten Sinema, has not conceded, and she wants all the votes to be counted before a winner is declared. So let's just kind of start with that. Earlier in the night on Tuesday, Mark Kelly addressed supporters and struck a pretty optimistic tone. He struck the same kind of tone that we've actually been hearing from him for quite some time, which is, I will go to Washington to get to work on the issues that you really care about. I will be a bipartisan senator. I will kind of almost be an apolitical senator and work to try to get things done. From the moment that results posted in this race, Kelly was leading by a very healthy margin. And, you know, his performance really tracked with Biden's. He seemed to do very good in the very urban areas of Maricopa and Pima County, and performed less well when compared to McSally in the rural areas, where McSally just really cleaned up. And these are areas that she has been really hitting hard. She's really worked to shore up conservative voters to try to galvanize them around her. And clearly that paid off. Unfortunately for her, it looks as though it wasn't enough. So Mark Kelly will join Democrat Kyrsten Sinema in the U.S. Senate because this is a special election to fill the remainder of the term left by the death of the late Senator John McCain. He could be sworn in as early as November 30th, which is when the state has to certify its election results by. November 30th, by the way, is also the same day that the Senate goes back into session. And that means that Mark Kelly will be at the table, will have a vote on any sort of legislation, judicial nominees that come before the U.S. Senate. It also means that Martha McSally must move out of her office on Capitol Hill fairly quickly.
So, Yvonne, one of the things that really kind of emerged as a theme late in the Senate race seemed to be what to do about a Democratic majority in the Senate, whether that would mean the end of the filibuster for all matters and what this might mean for packing the Supreme Court in the future as well under a Biden administration. Certainly, the presidential race is now up in the air. The Senate itself is also unclear as to who's going to have control come January. One thing that we do know is that Mark Kelly will be back on the ballot in 2022, seeking a full 6-year term in his own right. What can we expect from him given the likely pressures, whoever's in charge in the Oval Office or in the Senate?
You know, I would not expect him to become some sort of hyper-partisan, super liberal, all in for the progressive agenda kind of lawmaker. I would expect him to vote as he has campaigned, and perhaps we will see a departure on some of the issues, more progressive issues that maybe he feels as though he can, you know, put some space in between the more moderate flank of his party with. But, you know, he's got to get some things done for Arizona. He has got to make good on the promises, you know, that he has made. I don't know how quickly you can even do that in such a gridlocked Washington, but he needs to put points on the board. He is up for voters again. though he's going to take office very quickly, the election calendar is also very realistic. He must start running for re-election almost as soon as he has won this seat. All right, just briefly, Ron, let's talk a little bit about the congressional districts. There are 9 of them in Arizona, and our most loyal listeners will be familiar with them. We visited each of those 9 districts leading up to this election. Which were the most competitive or the most anticipated, and what do the results tell us so far?
Yeah, so the good news is that our 9-part series on the districts correctly noted that the ones that would be most competitive were the first district that spans northeastern Arizona and the 6th district that is based in Scottsdale and covers the Northeast Valley. And basically what we saw is that the other 7 incumbents won handily. No huge surprise with any of those races. Let's take them one at a time in the 2 that really kind of mattered. In the 1st district, Tom O'Halloran, a Democrat, as of 1:52 a.m. on Wednesday, has a narrow lead over Tiffany Shedd, the Republican challenger. This race started with Tom O'Halloran with a almost double-digit lead. His lead has come down. It seems to be floating around the 4-point margin at the moment. We'll have to see whether he can hold on to that lead. But one thing that does seem remarkable already is that this rural Arizona district has really continued to drift closer to the right. Even as Arizona moves further to the left as a whole, rural Arizona is moving to the right, making this a increasingly difficult seat for Democrats to hold on to. If you look at the 6th district, it's also the story of demographic change potentially. Democrat Hirol Tepperneni is leading Representative David Schweikert, the Republican who has represented this district since it was created in 2012. David Schweikert had an ethics case against him that ended with him accepting 11 ethics rules violations and a $50,000 fine. Tipperneni certainly used that to good effect to taint him as a corrupt politician who is part of this D.C. swamp. And she is leading in that race. But this is a district with a 12 percentage point advantage for Republicans. It's a tough seat for Democrats to hang on to. And really, apart from his ethics problems in Congress, there's just the reality that this is the kind of race that is hard for Democrats to win, but they can make it competitive now because of the shifting demographics of the Valley. Namely, these college-educated suburban districts have trended to the left. Hirol Tepperneni has been a very good candidate, very well-financed, and is able to keep that race in the Democratic column as of almost 2 a.m. on Wednesday.
What do those 2 key results tell us about what Arizona voters want?
Yeah, so I think that this one is really going to come down to sort of that national party ID that we see that in Tom O'Halloran's district. This is a Democrat who has been relatively active in trying to get out and be with his constituents. He's done more town halls by himself than the rest of the delegation combined. And yet he finds himself in a very tight race because, again, the constituents of that district are kind of drifting to the right, along with rural America more broadly. When you look at Hirol Tepperneni, yes, she had a significant financial advantage over David Schweikert, and yes, he was hampered by the ethics case against him. But I think that the fact that Democrats can compete there is mostly because Maricopa County in particular has moved well to the left in Arizona. We've seen that at the county level races. We saw it with the presidential race as well, where Donald Trump lost by more than 100,000 votes in Maricopa County. And no small part of that has to be because the Republican brand is not as strong in the Northeast Valley as it once was. And there's also the particular damage done with the continued hostility to John McCain. And so, you know, you put it all together and it just kind of made Democrats more competitive in that part of the valley than what they might have been otherwise. Up next, let's take a look at some of our state legislative races. Joining us to do that is state legislature reporter Andrew Oxford. Andrew, it is 12:45 a.m. on Wednesday morning. Good morning. What notable results do we have from the legislative races at this point?
Democrats seem to have a route to winning majorities in the state House and Senate. They had some surprising leads in some surprising places earlier in the night, looking competitive, for example, in District 11, where Felipe Perez looked like he might oust Representative Mark Fincham, the Republican incumbent. But as more ballots were counted, we see the electoral map shrinking to the races I think folks had long expected would decide control of the legislature this year. Senator Kate Brophy McGee is trailing Christine Marsh, a Democrat and school teacher. Senator Paul Boyer was also trailing in early results from the Glendale and Peoria area, where he was again facing Democrat Paul Ervin. Democrats only need to flip 3 Senate seats to win a majority and 2 House seats to take control of the House. And there seem to be some options for doing that.
Do we know yet which party will likely control the state House and Senate next year?
No, many of these are still close races with small and changing leads. I would not even rule out a tie in one chamber. I mean, it happened in the Senate a few decades ago, right?
Okay, so given that, what at this point stands out as the biggest surprise of the night?
There are a few. You know, District 4 looked like a potential bright spot for Republicans who otherwise had few prospects for gain in the legislature, and they might just win a seat there. Joel John, he's a former school teacher with an irrigation business. He's running as a Republican for the House down there. It's a district that runs all the way from Yuma to Tucson and the West Valley. He's targeted Representative Geraldine Peaton. He even raised more money than her during the summer. And he was ahead when I last checked by just shy of 100 votes. So that's a potential pickup for Republicans.
Andrew, what are some of the stories that you'll be paying attention to in the coming days after tonight?
Well, the legislators have to pick leaders, right? If Democrats win a majority, there will be a clash of some of the more progressive members and some of the more moderate lawmakers about how to govern going forward, right? You've already got a race for House Speaker between Charlene Fernandez, the current minority leader, and Diego Espinoza. And in the Senate, Layla Alston is vying to lead the Democrats, as is Rebecca Rios. Republican and Democratic caucuses will meet this week to talk about leadership. Obviously, it'll be all the more interesting if it's not even clear who really is going to be in control of the chambers.
Well, Andrew, thank you for joining us tonight. For listeners who want to keep an eye out for these stories and anything else you're doing, where can they follow you on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm at Andrew B. Oxford.
Now, turning to the 2 propositions on the ballot, let's take a quick look at the outcomes. Ron, what do we know about Proposition 207, the ballot initiative that would legalize recreational marijuana here?
Yeah, so Arizona voters approved Prop 207, and the ballot measure legalizes possession of as much as 1 ounce of marijuana for adults 21 and older. Recreational sales could begin as early as March. Arizona joins at least 11 other states to sell recreational marijuana despite a conflict with federal law. Make sure you follow the Republic's Ryan Randazzo for updates on this ballot initiative. Now, Yvonne, do we know the results of the Invest in Education ballot initiative, better known as Prop 208?
Early returns show Prop 208 leading, but that race has yet to be called. This Invest in Education ballot measure came out of the aftermath of the Red for Ed movement from 2018. The measure would add a 3.5% tax surcharge on taxable income over $250,000 for individuals and $500,000 for couples. Prop 208 had been leading in recent polls despite pretty fierce campaigns that were waged against the measure. It seemed to garner more support among Democrats and independents and less support from Republicans. Governor Doug Ducey opposed this tax increase, while state school superintendent Kathy Hoffman had voiced her support. To follow along with this coverage, you'll want to make sure you check out our education reporter's coverage, and you can follow her stories on AZ Central by typing in her byline, Lily Altavena.
Well, Gaggle listeners, that's all for this week. Thank you so much for listening.
And if you haven't subscribed to The Gaggle yet, you can find our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Subscribe now to make sure you're up to date on our biggest political stories coming from this election. I'm Yvonne Winget Sanchez, and if you want to follow along with my work, I'm on Twitter at Yvonne Winget.
And I'm at Ronald J. Hansen, and that's H-A-N-S-E-N.
Today's episode was produced by Maritza Dominguez and Taylor Seeley, with oversight from Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.